In the matter of John Robert Telly, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Stephen J. Zweig, Deputy Ethics Counsel, on behalf of the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Your Honors, Michael Stein, Passman Stein, Walter Hayden, here on behalf of John Robert Telly, who, as Your Honors can see, is in the courtroom and, if permitted, at the end of argument, would like to say a few words.
So, Mr. Stein, that's not our practice in cases that are not disbarment cases. Is there a particular reason you'd like him to address the court today?
Well, Your Honor, yes. It's been a long ordeal, and Mr. Robert Telly would like the opportunity to speak for 2 minutes, and I do understand it's unusual and completely understand if at the end of a long day there's not time for it.
I have your point. Let's proceed. Mr. Robert Telly, we'll give you 2 minutes at the end. Mr. Zweig, why don't you please start?
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, good afternoon. The issue here is, did the Office of Attorney Ethics clearly and convincingly prove that respondent John Robert Telly sent a communication about the subject of the representation when he directed his paralegal to send the represented party, Dennis Hernandez, a message intended to prompt him to send her a friend request so respondent could gain access to Mr. Hernandez's private Facebook account? Now, at the time of the events in question, a respondent was a partner and a manager in his law firm who had been practicing for 18 years. He was supervising both the paralegal named Valentina Madeline Cordova and another attorney named Gabrielle Adamo in litigation brought by Mr. Hernandez against several public entities in connections with injuries Mr. Hernandez sustained in the parking lot of the building in which the Borough of Oakland Police Department was located. Respondent and his firm represented the defendant borough, police department, and a police sergeant. Now, how do we know that respondent directed his paralegal to send the message to Mr. Hernandez, a party represented in the litigation by attorney Michael Epstein? Because Ms. Cordova, testified credibly, consistently, and cogently about that point at the hearing. She testified that after respondent tasked her with monitoring the social media accounts of Mr. Hernandez, she at some point explained to respondent what it meant to be a friend on Facebook. She testified that at first Mr. Hernandez's Facebook page was public, but at some point his page became private. She testified that she told respondent when his page became private. She testified that respondent at that point told her to hold off on doing anything further. He had to check with the adjuster. She testified that after respondent checked with the adjuster, he specifically instructed her, don't send him a friend request, just send a general message. After she sent Mr. Hernandez a message telling him that he resembled one of her favorite hockey players, Scott Gomez of the New Jersey Devils, I believe, she told respondent what she had put in the message. She testified that Mr. Hernandez then sent her a flirtatious message and a friend request, which she accepted, giving her access to Mr. Hernandez's private Facebook page. She subsequently saw on that private Facebook page a video of Mr. Hernandez wrestling with his brother that allegedly postdated Mr. Hernandez's injuries and which would not have been available if she were not Mr. Hernandez's Facebook friend. She testified that at the time she sent the message, she did not tell Mr. Hernandez that she worked for the defendant's law firm, nor did she disclose where she worked. I should also point out that on her Facebook profile, she did not disclose where she worked as well. And the reason she did not say that in her message is because she wanted Mr. Hernandez to send her a friend request so she could gain access to his Facebook page. She further testified that respondent was well aware that and was well aware and understood and knew that it was her purpose, that this was her purpose in sending Mr. Hernandez a message, that it was her purpose in sending him that message to get him to send her a friend request. She testified that she explained to respondent that if she became friends with Mr. Hernandez on Facebook, she would be able to see Mr. Hernandez's private Facebook material. Under questioning from the special master, she testified that she had a conversation with respondent in which she explained what it meant to send a message or to be a friend with somebody on Facebook. Specifically, she testified that she told respondent that she couldn't view Mr. Hernandez's page and fully see the content of what he posted and what other people posted on his page unless she was his friend. She further testified that respondent told her, quote, "We have to be very careful about how we communicate with him because he, Mr. Hernandez, is a represented party." She testified that respondent told her, quote, "I couldn't just freely do things, neither could he. He, respondent, would check back to see if certain things like were okay." And the special master pursued that and said, like, what kinds of things? Sending the message, for example, she said. And sending the message, yes. She further testified that after she told respondent that I could send a friend request, he told her not to do that, but that sending a message was fine. After the special master asked his questions, the following colloquy occurred on redirect. What exactly did you explain to Mr. Robertelli when you explained that process? The basic, that the process, that the profile was public at one point, and for me to gain information from his page, I would have to either send him a friend request or I could send him a message and hope that he would send me a friend request so that I could view the page. And specifically with the friend request, did you explain to him that, he being respondent, that I just want to make sure I understand exactly what you, did you explain to him that Mr. Hernandez would have to either accept or reject the request or not, you know, the process of how exactly you become a friend on Facebook. Did you explain that to him? She said, yes. And did he appear confused after you explained it to him at that time? I still think he didn't fully understand. Question, you would testify that Mr. Robertelli said, go ahead and send a message. Is that correct? Yes. Okay. At that time, did he appear confused about what it meant to send a message? She said, no. I'm sorry, no. And I believe you testified on cross that Robertelli was unsure about Facebook or what a friend request was. Is that correct? I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I believe you testified on cross-examination that Mr. Robertelli was unsure about Facebook was and what a friend request was. Yes, correct. And so then did you explain it to Mr. Robertelli at that time? Yes. And did Mr. Robertelli ask you questions in response to your explanation? Yes. And did you explain further in response to his inquiries about these different things, Facebook and friend requests? Yes, yes.
Mr. Zwei?
Yes.
Can you please tell us what, if any, concerns or doubts the special master had about the paralegal's testimony?
The special master's, in my view, did not give sufficient credence to the paralegal's testimony. He seemed to
Tell us first what the special master said, and then put it in context as you best see it.
Sure. So he improperly disregarded the Ms. Cordova's testimony because she had laryngitis, and he also he cited the fact that her, you know, there were several times during the testimony that her recollection needed to be refreshed, and so he those were the concerns that he had with her testimony. The DRB majority stated that those were not reasons to discount the paralegal's testimony. If anything, the fact that you know, that she had to have a recollection refreshed actually made her testimony more credible. And the DRB said, this is a rare instance that we do not accept a credibility determination made by a trier of fact.
Counsel, didn't, tell me if I'm mistaken, didn't the special master also say that because Ms. Cordova and the other witnesses were recalling events that were 10 years old, that he came to the conclusion that she was looking at events from the more from the present and her knowledge of the present than she was at the time when the events occurred? Did he not also say that?
He did say that. I think he disregarded the evidence of she was interviewed very shortly after the incidents took place. And actually, well, she was interviewed by the OAE in 2011. She was interviewed by the plaintiff, by the plaintiff's counsel in 2012. And then she was interviewed again by the OAE approximately 5 weeks before the hearing. And in fact, all of those memos of her interview are in the record, and you'll see that her testimony, her statements are consistent throughout.
But it's not as though her testimony was unrebutted. Mr. Robertelli testified; he had a different recollection. So my question to you: the special master was invested with the responsibility of determining credibility and making fact-finding calls. And he seemed to believe Mr. Robertelli didn't have a sufficient understanding of the technology of the time, what Facebook meant, what friending meant. He didn't know those terms. Those were findings of fact that the special master made. Why should they be disregarded?
Well, I think because he was focusing on irrelevant factors in disregarding entirely Ms. Cordova's testimony. As I just said, he seemed to discount her testimony because of her laryngitis. And if I may add,
what exactly did the special master find about her testimony being in the present? I don't understand what that finding was. Could you repeat it and explain to me what you think the special master meant?
I think that the special master improperly disregarded the testimony of Ms. Cordova because, number one, of her laryngitis, and number two, because her recollection needed to be refreshed a few times. Yes. During her testimony. But one thing I would like to say is,
specific comment by the special master about her testimony was looked at from the present or something like that. I didn't quite understand that.
I'm sorry, Justice Fernandez-Vina, I didn't understand. I'm not.
At one point you were asked, I think.
Here's maybe I can help. Here's the sentence at the bottom.
I'm sorry, I can't find it on the transcript. That's why I'm asking to repeat it so I can write it down.
So I'm just looking at the DRB's opinion at page 12. Going to that point, Justice, the special master surmised that the paralegal's testimony regarding Facebook was more reflective of what she had learned in the intervening 10 years rather than what she knew in 2008. That's attributed to the special master.
Thank you, Chief.
Yeah. In my response to that, Justice Fernandez-Vina and Justice Albin, is that her testimony was consistent with statements that she made much closer in time to the events in question. And I believe those statements are marked as exhibits at the hearing. I know that the OAE's interview of her was entered into evidence. The respondents counsel interviewed her, I believe, in September of 2012. And so her statements remarkably consistent throughout.
But he also, the special master also made findings concerning Mr. Robertelli's credibility. And I'm looking at page 15 of the special master's report. And this is what he said. I specifically find that there is no clear and convincing evidence that respondent ever told Cordova to friend Hernandez. Nor do I believe respondent even knew what friending meant. And there is absolutely no evidence that respondent knowingly and intentionally directed his employee to communicate with Hernandez. It goes on. I don't want to continue to read it. The only reason why I'm pointing this out is because it wasn't as though just Ms. Cordova testified, Mr. Robertelli testified as well. And he gave his recollection of the events, and it seems that the special master credited him. Why should that be disregarded?
Well, although in contrast to Ms. Cordova's testimony, that was very consistent and clear throughout the investigation and the litigated proceedings, respondents' testimony and timeline shifted over time. And the DRB pointed that out as in the exercise of their de novo review. They pointed that out in their majority decision. For example, respondent admitted on the second day of the hearing that Ms. Cordobo told him that Mr. Hernandez's Facebook settings had switched to a semi-private setting, and that that conversation occurred before Ms. Cordobo retrieved the wrestling video on November 4th, 2008. That testimony was consistent with Ms. Cordobo's testimony concerning the timing of events, and that she always kept the respondent informed about her research.
It's assuming that even someone would in 2008, not with their knowledge of Facebook in 2021, would even know what semi-private settings are. So look, the question is whether one of the issues we have to decide is whether or not the special master's findings are entitled to deference, or whether or not we're going to completely re-examine the testimony and make credibility findings all on our own, the way the DRB did.
Well, I think that in addition to the shifting of his testimony during the hearing, and again, the DRB is exercising its de novo review and looking at the evidence, looking at the fact that the special master is seeming to put a lot of stock in the fact that Ms. Cordobo had a cold on the day in question. They're looking at it through de novo review. They're looking at the testimony and the changing, the way that respondent's testimony shifts over time. One of the things that's interesting is that in his own verified answer, the respondent also acknowledges that that at some point Mr. Hernandez's page was marked private, and that she informed him that she could still view Mr. Hernandez's information if she were his friend on Facebook. That's what he said in his verified answer. That's at paragraph 3 at R32.
But Mr. Zweig, in the context of what he appears to have known or not known about the way Facebook worked at that time, not today, but at that time, how much does that really mean? She told him that. What did that really mean to him?
It means what she's saying is that she told him that he directed her to send Mr. Hernandez a message. And it doesn't matter what the medium is that message is sent, whether it's text or email or on the telephone. He endorsed and ratified and told her to send the message to Mr. Hernandez, a party that he knew was represented, so that he could gain access to Mr. Hernandez's private Facebook page. That's what she testified to. She has no motive to lie. She came in and she's testified consistently throughout. And the special master completely disregarded that, completely. Another thing that the special master did was he completely failed to address the charges under 5.3 A and B, A, B, and C, the failure to supervise.
When you say that she had no motive to lie, is that really true? Considering the various different ways this could have gone at the beginning of this process?
I mean, she left on good terms from the firm, from Mr. respondent's firm. There were no performance issues.
Right, my point is that when all this seemed to have started to really become a serious issue, could she have anticipated that she might be in some kind of legal peril? Obviously, she wasn't a lawyer, so she's not going to have a disciplinary issue, but that she might have a motive to say, I was told to do this.
She was asked and she was told during the hearing, you're not in any trouble. That was something that she was told from the beginning and certainly at the hearing by the special master. So, I don't think that was a concern on her part. I think she was very truthful and very forthright. And again, the special master completely disregarded that testimony. I think the special master was so anxious to get to the second part of why we're here, which is the policy issues, that he just gave it no credence. And the reasons that he gave it no credence, the asserted reasons, really don't make any sense. So I think this is one instance where one of those rare instances where the DRB, in exercising its de novo review, was appropriately did not accept that credibility determination.
Mr. Zweig, let's accept for purposes of this argument for a moment that Mr. Robertelli didn't have the appreciation and fine understanding of Facebook that he perhaps should have had. What does that tell us about his supervision of the paralegal? What should he have done? What did he or did he not do?
Well, what he should have done is he should have, there were at least two opportunities to stop, look, and listen, right? The first opportunity to do that was when she told him that the Facebook page was had gone from public to private, and he called the insurance adjuster. That was an opportunity for him to learn more about Facebook and make sure that he wasn't doing anything that was violating his responsibilities. The other time that he could have taken that opportunity was after she had pulled the video, and before he affirmatively used the video by amending his answers to interrogatories to name Ms. Cordova as a Facebook friend. So those were two times when he could have stopped and learned more about what she had done. And it wouldn't have taken very long. You know, we talk about, it's funny because the special master, he analogizes Facebook between now and then to a horse and buggy and an automobile. But in reality, in 2007, Facebook had 30 million users. It wouldn't have taken very long for him to figure out that, sending a message, sending a friend request or sending a message to elicit a friend request. So I can now view a part of the Facebook, a part of his Facebook page, which is private, would present significant issues under RPC 4.2.
If he thought it was, you're imputing to him the knowledge that he should have known that it was wrong, or perhaps knew it was wrong, but yet he turned over the video in discovery, which led to the other side filing the charges against him. That would seem to be not a very smart move if you knew what you're doing. You agree?
Again, Justice Albin, we're not required to show that he knew it was wrong. We're required to show that he knew that he directed his paralegal to send a communication to a represented party about the subject of that representation. That's all we have to show in terms of our requirements for mens rea, to show that he violated the rules. So, again, we have Ms. Cordova testifying that clearly, credibly, consistently. We have him shifting in his explanations. First, he said, I didn't know it was private or public. And then when he's questioned by the special master, suddenly he acknowledges that he understood that the settings had changed from public to private. He's saying that is in his answer. He's utilizing it, he's changing his testimony. Like I said, he's trying to walk back the things that he said in his answer when we get to the hearing. As the DRB properly found, both respondent and Ms. Cordova agreed that respondent told her to hold off at first, but then directed her to proceed. That is the moment he failed to take reasonable action to avoid or mitigate the consequences of Ms. Cordova's conduct, and thereby violated RPC 5.3C2. Ignorance cannot be used as a shield. Respondent identified Ms. Cordova as Mr. Hernandez's Facebook friend in a letter to the council in supplemental answers to interrogatories before anyone accused him of violating the RPCs. He conducted no factual investigation into Ms. Cordova's conduct in response to counsel's accusations of misconduct. He sent an email to his associate, Mr. Odama, I thought you had looked into this, after Mr. Epstein accused him of violating the rules of professional conduct. In other words, respondent knew what he was doing and did it with eyes wide open. Now, I would like to address very quickly the issue of the novelty of the issue.
But before you move off, the question on that last point about eyes wide open, it has to be clear and convincing evidence that the eyes wide open was that it was a violation of the ethics provision. How do you make that last connection, Mr. Zweig?
Justice Lavecchia, I don't know if we're required to show, and I know there's some case law on this, that he knew when he took these actions that he was violating the rules of professional conduct. I think what we need to show is that he sent a communication, that he knowingly sent a communication to a represented party about the subject of that communication. And I think we've shown that. I think the fallback position is that even if he didn't know, he knew enough. He ratified, once he did know what had happened, he ratified Ms. Cordoba's conduct when he then used the fruits of her improper surveillance in the litigation. And thereby he violated RPC 5.3. So, we've shown that,
It's not a preponderance standard. It's clear and convincing. It's a difficult standard.
It is a difficult standard, but I believe we showed that through the testimony of the paralegal, through his incredible denials, and through the way that this was used. He names her as a Facebook, he claims, I don't know anything about Facebook, and yet he identifies her as a Facebook friend in modifying the answers to interrogatories.
That doesn't tell me very much. I mean, anybody who doesn't even know that much about Facebook has heard the term Facebook friend.
Right, but in litigation, he understood how that information had been obtained. He understood that the information had been about the wrestling video had been obtained because he had used a ruse to gain access to Mr. Hernandez's private Facebook page. He's claiming I didn't know anything about that. That's not consistent with his conduct, with the conduct that we've shown, with his behavior. That's inconsistent with the way he acted. He knew how the information had been obtained, and that's all we need to show, that he knew that when Ms. Cordoba sent that message, that was a communication to a represented party. And even if he didn't know that, he at some point became aware of that, and he instead of stopping, he ratified it. He used it to try to gain advantage in the litigation.
I understand your position. Don't let me stop you from moving on to your next point.
Yes, ma'am. So I just want to briefly address the issue of the novelty of the issue. Each change in technology does not necessitate a change in the rules, obviously. If the rule says it prohibits communication with a represented party about the subject of the communication, it doesn't say communication by email, it doesn't say communication by telegraph or telephone, it just says communication. Everybody understands what communication is, and there's no need to keep having a different decision to say, oh, it also applies to emails, or it also applies to a texting. You know, there's been no law on that in the past because everybody understands that the issue is communication. Moreover, as I said before, even if he didn't understand it, Ms. Cordoba explained what Facebook was and how it worked. Her testimony bridges that knowledge gap for purposes of meeting our burden clearly and convincing. I would also like to address briefly the passage of time. To a certain extent, respondent is himself to blame for that. I'd like to address the passage of time and the notoriety. And to a certain extent, respondent is responsible for both of those. As you know, he brought an action which challenged the authority of the director to initiate this investigation after a district dismissed it. And that led to a large delay. And ultimately this court decided that the director did have that authority and published, indicated that in a published decision. And of course, his name's associated with that. But again, that was a decision to a large degree as a result of his decision in that regard.
How much time did that take from start to finish? How much time did that take, Mr. Zweig?
From start to finish, that in and of itself, Mr. Chief Justice, was approximately 3 years and 7 months. I believe it was 42 months. 43 months. So there's been no remorse or response, you know, in terms of the sanction briefly. There's been no remorse in the before the special master. Respondent argued that Mr. Hernandez should not have accepted the message. You know, that indicates a lack of remorse. In light of his experience and the lack of remorse, we believe that a reprimand is the appropriate penalty for this garden variety violation of RPC 4.2 and the other violations.
Questions, anyone, for Mr. Zwei? Thank you. Thank Mr. Stein.
Thank you, and may it please the court. The purpose of discipline is not to punish. It's not supposed to act like a gotcha. The purpose is to protect the public from the attorney who does not meet his ethical responsibilities. That is not John Robertelli, not 12 years ago, and certainly not today. Any finding of improper conduct should be applied prospectively and not to this respondent, a widely respected veteran attorney with an unblemished record who has suffered unnecessarily, I would argue, under the bright lights of this case for 12 years and counting. I've been urging the OAE for a decade to drop this prosecution of what was at worst an inadvertent mistake and to jointly request submission of this issue to a committee to more quickly obtain needed guidance to the bar. I remain bewildered by its refusal to do so, even after the overwhelming record developed before the special master. 12 years later, and the bar still needs guidance from the court on what lawyers can and can't do on social media, which continues, by the way, to evolve. Facebook has begotten Snapchat, Twitter, YouTube, WhatsApp, Tumblr, Instagram, TikTok. They all work differently. They all raise issues calling out for review and guidance. The record and context here underscores the unfairness of imposing discipline on the respondent. First, the special master found by clear and convincing evidence based mainly on credibility determinations that respondent's understanding of the internet was limited, that he proceeded under the misimpression that everything posted on the internet was available to the public, that he was told that the location of Mr. Hernandez's information had changed and can now be accessed by a click of a button, that he never told his paralegal to, quote, friend Mr. Hernandez, and that respondent didn't even know what friending meant. And the special master found that there was no evidence that respondent knowingly or intentionally directed his paralegal to communicate with Mr. Hernandez for the purpose of obtaining informal discovery. For no good reason, at least none that I could discern, the majority DRB decision decided not to accord the substantial deference to these and other credibility determinations normally given to those who preside over plenary hearings. Second, it's indisputable that social media was in its infancy in 2008. Until the end of 06, you needed an EDU email address to access Facebook. You had to be a student. It wasn't until mid-08 when these facts were ongoing, that the Facebook app was even available on your mobile phone. The percentage of social media users in 2008 who were in their 50s was in the teens. The median age of users was 26. In 2008, only 15% of lawyers used social media, and almost none of them did so for professional purposes. Third, this court has recognized that the issue presented by the case is novel. To date, no reported case law in our state addresses the question. To the contention that it should nonetheless have been obvious to respondent that the friending that took place violated RPCs 4.2 and 8.4C, I offer the following. In our jurisdiction, there still is no case law suggesting that motive to procure evidence can somehow transform a communication that has absolutely nothing to do about the subject matter of a litigation into one that does. In 2008, it was eminently reasonable to rely on the AppleCourt case for the proposition that RPC 8.4C does not apply to misrepresentation solely as to identity or purpose. Significantly, beginning in 2009 and continuing to date, lawyers all over the country have sought out advisory opinions on this very issue, evidencing the bar's substantial need nationwide for guidance. It is, I would submit, understandable that Judge Horace declined to refer the matter to the OAE. that the DEC secretary and public member declined even to docket the grievance, that the special master found no ethical misconduct based on what was understood at the time, and that the hearing before the DRB engendered four different opinions. Final point in my prepared statement, to the OAE's suggestion that respondent had a duty to educate himself, that he engaged in willful blindness and therefore failed to adequately supervise his paralegal, I would say this. It would be grossly unfair to fault the respondent for not knowing what he didn't know. Our case law recognizes the difference between willful blindness and legitimate lack of knowledge. Here, the respondent simply did not understand this brand new medium. That is the end of my prepared statement. And if there's no questions, I'll move on with my argument. The overriding point that I want to make is this.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Can you continue the thread of the last point that you made and accepting what preceded it? Given that this was novel, given that he didn't fully understand it, why shouldn't he then have had responsibility to say, hey, tell me a little bit more about this before you go down that road? I need to know more.
Hey, look. Hindsight is always 20/20. The standard is reasonable efforts to ensure that your subordinates don't violate the rules of ethics.
Did he satisfy that standard, and how so?
Yeah, well, because he knew what a lawyer should have known in 2008. And you know, I tried to come up with an analogy to drive home the point. I don't know if this works, but let me try it. Imagine you're driving your car and you blow through a stop sign that is obscured by overgrown brush. You didn't see the stop sign. It was invisible to you. It was there, but it was covered. Are you going to be found guilty of going through a stop sign? Now, in the way I'm conceptualizing this, the stop sign is RPC 4.2. Facebook is the brush that's obscuring your view of the stop sign. The point is this, if you could try, and I've had a long opportunity to think about this, and I'm the same age as respondent, but the demographics of this court are similar to mine. If you could try to roll back the clock and think about what it is you understood this new medium to be back when it was in its infancy, I think that the takeaway has to be that there was nothing unreasonable about the way that Mr. Robertelli conducted himself and oversaw his paralegal. He was used to internet searches. I mean, he had instructed her to conduct internet searches in the past. He had no idea that something could be on the internet and not available to the public. He thought that you click a button and you get to another part of the internet. That's what he believed. And there's no reason for this court to second guess the credibility determinations on that issue and the others of the special master, I would say.
Fine. How about the argument that he failed to properly supervise his paralegal? Since he sent her out to do this investigation, that he should have been sufficiently monitoring her and getting feedback so that he would understand precisely what she was doing.
Right. Justice Albin, I'd offer the same argument that I just offered to the Chief Justice. He didn't know what he didn't know. And the standard is to act reasonably under the circumstances. He knew what a reasonable lawyer should have known at the time. I mean, I thought about it a lot, and I could easily imagine being blindsided by this. You're told by your paralegal that you got to click a button and go to another part of the internet. You have no reason to believe that anything on the internet is, quote, private. You think it's all public. You're not thinking that she's communicating with the other side. You're not thinking that she's acting deceptively. You miss the issue. It doesn't hit your radar. I don't think that that is what the court contemplated when it promulgated RPC 5.3 and set a reasonableness standard to it. And again, if, you know, I remember kind of wondering what it meant to be a friend on Facebook way back when. Now I get it. But there was a time that I just didn't. And you know, What do you mean you're his friend? What is that? How do you become a friend? Don't you remember not understanding this medium? Well, that's what Mr. Robert Tetley confronted back in 2008. A couple things I'll add. There is an intent requirement to 8.4C. So not only, look, I can't see a principal basis to distinguish what happened here to the facts in the Apple Court case. Now, I'm not at all offended by a rule going forward that says you can't do what happened here, but there's no way on this record that any court, I would submit, can find that Mr. Robert Tetley intended to misrepresent anything to anyone. So not only is there no clear and convincing evidence of anything that happened here, but on the 8.4C violation, there's zero evidence that he intended to do anything inappropriate. And on that basis alone, you can't find a violation of 8.4C. And on prospectivity, I think I've made—
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Stein? Before we go to prospectivity, and I'm glad you came back to the clear and convincing evidence standard, but the court always is worried and has to wonder, how do we ensure or prompt lawyers to engage in right behavior when they're all alone, when they're all by themselves and they're confronted with an unusual or new circumstance? So if these questions can only be answered through when they arise, more clear rules, or hopefully someone will request an advisory opinion, are we powerless to use the ethics system and the imposition of discipline to underscore the importance of telling lawyers when they are alone to stop and take good care and maybe take the extra step of asking the question before they act?
Right.
Can you help me with that?
Yeah, look, of course this court's not powerless to do that. You could do that, but I'd urge you not to, because I think that part of the ethics process is to educate the bar. And I think this particular respondent has gotten the message loud and clear. He has learned a lesson. He has suffered significantly, and whether he was the cause of any of the notoriety of this case or not, this has been a burden that he's been carrying for 12 years. But I think the overriding point here, and what this case tells us, this case, and what the different rulings by Judge Harris, the DEC, the special master, and even the DRB tells us, is that the bar needs guidance. That's what we need more than anything else. And no good purpose would be served. My overriding point, frankly, is no good purpose would be served by disciplining Mr. Robert Tetley, who is, in my view, everything that a lawyer ought to be. He has, as I said, an unblemished record. And you've read the references from, among others, a former assignment Judge Doyne, and he's involved in his church and his community. And to say he's not remorseful, if he could go back in time and redo what happened, I promise you he would do so. But no good purpose would be served by blemishing the record of an attorney such as Mr. Robert Tetley.
So I take it from your response that, and where you went with it in your subsequent answer, we don't need the imposition of discipline to make the point of clarification in the law and providing guidance for the future, correct?
Yes, I would urge that with every fiber of my body. We don't need that in this case. And, and I'm not just a believer, but I have the utmost respect for our ethics system and for this court's supervisory authority, but that's not what is needed here. What's needed here is guidance. And the final thing that I'm gonna say, because I think my prospectivity argument has been made both in the briefing and in my opening, I do think that Roseny versus Jabak case. I'm probably butchering the way it's read. That Connecticut case, I don't know if the court got it, but it came out in July of this year. So we didn't catch it when we were briefing. It actually came out a week before our briefing was due. And the significance of that case, I think it's the only court, as distinguished from bar associations and advisory opinions, to have looked at the issue. And it was an unrepresented party, but of significance, the court there exercised its discretion not to impose discipline because of the novel nature in which the rule was being applied. And what's notable is that the conduct there occurred in 2020 versus here, where it took place in 2008. So I'll rely on
that. That case did not involve a represented party.
And
that's what distinguishes that case from this case, correct?
That's right, Justice Alvin. But the principle that I'm citing it for would be, I think, the same, because it's a new principle of law, whether you apply it to a represented party or an unrepresented party. And the point is that that court determined to apply it only prospectively. Now, many, many advisory opinions throughout the nation have concluded that there ought be no distinction in terms of how you apply the rules to represented versus unrepresented party. My own view would be that there should be a distinction for reasons I could share, but I don't think it's material to the prospectivity argument.
Any other questions? Mr. Stein, anything to add?
Nothing.
Thank you. Mr. Robertelli, did you want to address the court for 2 minutes?
Thank you, Chief Justice and the distinguished justices of the Supreme Court. Thank you for granting this petition and for giving Mr. Stein and myself an opportunity to be heard. I believe that if anything good can come out of this longstanding case, it will serve as a guide to the bar. I hope that your guidance will educate and hopefully prevent another attorney from reliving the experience that I've endured for the past 12 years. And although it may be extremely difficult to put this matter into context, given how the technology has changed since 2008, I'd like to state that none of my actions had any intent to harm anyone, and I always believed them to be professional based upon the information I had at the time. Looking back 12 years, I was unaware of what this situation presented. At that time, I acted based upon information that I understood to be available to everyone. Since that time, I've learned many things from this experience. One is the devastating effect that social media can have on a person's reputation and family. A Google search of my name today brings a flurry of law review articles amidst allegations of unethical conduct. I've been told that this matter is one of the longest standing ethics matters in New Jersey. And as a result, and based upon the limited knowledge that I have and that I still have or had at the time, I've been referred to as the Facebook attorney. Although I've never had a Facebook account and I'm not on social media. And still I've been told by my colleagues that I eventually will probably have an informal rule that will be named after me. And unfortunately for me, this is not a situation where any publicity is good publicity. As is the case with this form of media, before I even had my day in court, I had been tried in the court of public opinion. This matter was discussed in my church, on the Little League ball fields in my town. I expect that my children, who will come of age soon, will be asking questions about what's on when they Google our name. I've sat through numerous ICL seminars in the last decade and had this case mentioned, and not always correctly. Although I'm anything but tech savvy, I've received calls from attorneys and legal scholars from all over the country asking me for guidance, and I can give them none. I've sat in depositions, I've had adverse parties raise this case because they Googled my name the night before and tried to discredit me. I've had opposing counsel reference this case in court submissions to suggest that I'm unfit to practice law. I've had my firm's competitors send copies of the ethics complaint to my clients. As a trial lawyer of 30 years, every time I pick a jury, I have a concern that they will go home and Google my name and that will weigh against my client. And although my children were in diapers when this happened, my two older children are now approaching their college years, and I have a concern that a college admissions director will Google my name, and this case will weigh on their admission. As a member of the bar for the past 3 decades with no other ethics history, I've taken our rules of professional conduct very seriously. I strongly trust in your judgment. If this case can be used to help the bar and the public, it is a good thing. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Robertelli. Thank you to all. We will take the matter under advisement.